Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. If you ask most people about the early history of human flight, they're likely to rattle off the names Orville and Wilbur Wright. And it's true, the American brothers were the first humans to fly in a powered flying machine. But that's only part of the story. National Book Award winner Martin Sandler brings us another important piece of flight history in his latest book titled Race Through the Skies, The Week the World Learned to Fly. The book introduces us to the people, achievements, and mishaps that introduced the world to the wonder of flight. Marty, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So we take flying for granted today, but it was just over 100 years ago that it was considered a fantasy that humans could fly. So it's pretty amazing to think of the advances, and not just flying, that humans have made over the past 100 years.
Yeah, you know, what I had said in the introduction of the book, that Igor Sikorsky had said, you know, aviation wasn't a science, it was a miracle. And it really was true. I mean, you know, when the first international air meet took place at REMS, which is his book is really all about, there were only 32 pilots in the world. P.S., 28 of them were dead about 3 weeks later from crashes. It was just an extraordinary time, and yet they changed the world.
So let's start with some of the key events in flight that happened in the years leading up to that week of flight in Rance. It was December of 1903 that the Wright brothers flew an airplane for 58 seconds. And this was an achievement only dreamt of, yet it didn't even make the newspapers. Why?
Well, and it was on purpose, because the Wright brothers were much more interested in getting patents for that plane. They wanted to make a lot of money. Now, that does not in any way diminish their achievement, but they flew for 58 seconds. In fact, they never gave the word to their brother, Lauren, who raced down after they had flown for 56 seconds, raced down to the local newspaper, and he grabbed the editor and said, we've flown, and he said, how long, 56 seconds? And the editor said, 56 seconds. He said, it had been 56 minutes, then I'd put it in the paper. So, but that's just what the Wright brothers wanted. And in fact, what they did after the flight, nobody in Europe, and it was France was the only other place that was really starting to fly, nobody in Europe believed that the Wright brothers had flown. They thought they were a hoax. The Wright brothers kind of wanted it that way because they wanted to concentrate on getting every patent on every part of that airplane. And they went off to Huffman Prairie in Maryland and started working on their plane to perfect it. And once they got it where they thought it was really coming along, they went 3 years without ever stepping into a cockpit. And they went 3 years and never flew. And then finally, in 1908, they said, all right, we're ready to show the world. And that's when Wilbur went off to France to demonstrate what they really could do.
Yeah. Now, before that, in October of 1905, the Wright brothers had honed the design of their aircraft and flown a plane that stayed aloft for almost 40 minutes. They could bank, turn, and circle, but few believed them, right? So 1908, Wilbur Wright heads to France with his airplane packed up in crates. So tell us a little bit about the purpose of that trip.
Well, so he goes over there to get contracts for his new their new air production company. But mainly he goes over there to quell all the doubts, to show the French, and boy, the French were vicious in their criticism. This man never flew. This man is a hoax. He's going to show them. And he has a temporary setback because he goes over. Orville stays back in America because he's trying to convince the United States Army to buy the first airplane any military has ever bought. And Wilbur goes over to do the flights, and when he finally says he's ready to show them, the day of that flight on a racetrack, over a racetrack in Le Mans in France, it's packed with people just waiting to boo him and hiss him and make fun of him, and he gets up in the air, and he only flies 2 minutes, but he does loop the loops, he does dives, he does circles. He gives the most extraordinary exhibition of flying anyone could have imagined, and you know, the quotes that I found are incredible. Like, he's no bluffer. He's the greatest man in the world. He becomes an international hero, and he just stays in France for a couple of months, taking people on flights, showing the world that yes, flight is not only possible, it's here, and I've done it.
Yeah. But when he starts to unpack his Wright Flyer in France, yeah. he had a little bit of an unpleasant surprise.
Yes, he did. What happened is he would only trust Orville to pack the plane. Of course, no plane. He couldn't fly it to France because it certainly couldn't go that far. So they pack it in crates and they pack it meticulously. What happens is when it lands in Le Havre, in the French port of Le Havre, the customs people just unpack it and just throw it back in any old way, haphazardly, and Wilbur has the shock of his life, and he actually has to spend like 2 weeks putting that plane back together again.
Yeah. So Wilbur takes to the air in Le Mans, and this time there are press from London, Paris, New York, and other cities around the world. Why was there so much more interest in flying in Europe than in the U.S.?
Well, it probably was a coincidence, but they were in America. They had had earlier success in France, and even though Wright absolutely were the first to do a powered flight for 58 seconds, although there's a great case can be made for a Brazilian man named Santos, who flew in Brazil, and to this day there are people who say that he flew a year ahead of the Wrights, but the Wrights were smart enough to have a photographer at their flight. But it doesn't matter. The point is that while he's in France, he is convincing these people that, yes, it's real. And what's really important, Mindy, is that in that audience are some very interesting people. Not only are the greatest critics of them there, and they all say, we were wrong, he's a genius, blah, 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 but there are men like Louis Blériot sitting there, and Hubert Latham sitting there. And what happens is probably the most important person in many ways sitting watching these flights is a guy named Albert Harnsworth, who goes by the name of Lord Northington. And Lord Northington, he is the owner of the London Daily Mail. He's an incredible guy. He's an eccentric. He's kind of a nut, but he's very, very rich, and he does something in journalism that changes the entire world of journalism. Up until this time, newspapers really were written for the rich. Those are the ones who could afford the papers. And so it's all the stories about society and that stuff. Lord Northcliffe, is the first one who starts writing stories for the people. And it's a sensation, and he changes the whole world of journalism. Newspapers all over the world start copying him. And what he does next is he's there to watch the Wilbur Wright's flights. He's a real, real nut about flying. And so he does something that will change the whole world of flight. He offers what in today's money would be $500,000 prize to the first pilot who can fly across the English Channel. Doesn't matter if they go from France to England or from England to France, and they got to do it beginning at dawn and get there before dusk. And, you know, today you look at the English Channel, you see the English Channel, in those days that was like saying, we'll give the $500,000 to someone flying the Atlantic. It was always foggy. It was always incredibly rough. No one had ever flown over open water before. And it's always, always 50 and 60 mile an hour winds. And he offers this incredible prize, and only two people really, really pick up the challenge. One is a guy named Louis Blériot, a Frenchman who has watched the demonstrations. Blériot is a man who has become rich by being an inventor, and he's the one who invented the headlights for the automobile. And by inventing headlights for automobiles, he became incredibly rich. He spent all his money on developing different kinds of aircraft. He becomes known as the man who always crashes. Somehow he reminds me of Tom Brady. He keeps getting hit and getting up. But Blériot continually crashes, but he continually gets up and makes what he thinks is a better plane, and he's going to try it. The other guy is an idol, the idol of the women. He is handsome. His name is Hubert Latham. And he is gorgeous looking, and he's debonair, and he likes to drink, and he likes to party, but he's a damn good pilot. And these are the two who finally pick up the challenge. And so they both set up camps on the French side, on the English side. I'll start that again. On the French side of the English Channel. are not that far apart. And Latham is the first to try it. And he gets out there about 7 miles, and suddenly both of the wings on his plane collapse. So he crashes into the ocean, and by crashing into the English Channel, Hubert Latham becomes the first human being ever to crash into the sea. But he doesn't care because he's Hubert Latham. So he's sitting on the wing, smoking a cigarette, wearing a hat with a pom-pom, when the rescuers come. And they bring him back to England, where mobs of women are waiting for him, and he swears that within the next 2 weeks he'll have another plane, and he will go. Well, he's getting ready. Blériot is getting ready. Latham goes to bed one night saying, you know, it might clear tomorrow. Wake me up at 3 o'clock. So that's what he tells his engineers and his mechanics. They forget to wake him. To this day, no one knows how the hell that could have happened. They forget. So meanwhile, while he's asleep, Blériot notices that the sky has cleared. So Blériot takes off, and he has this incredible flight, less than half an hour, but this incredible flight where he really never sees open sky, where it's cloudy the whole way, where the winds are blowing. You have to understand also, Mindy, that these planes are made of scotch tape and chewing gum. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that's why there's yep. so many crashes. And it's an open cockpit. These guys are sitting up in the freezing cold up in the air with the winds howling with absolutely no protection. Worse yet, none of these. There's only one airplane motor in the world that's got any kind of quality to it. It happens to be the one built by Blériot. And that's why Latham crashed the first time, because his engine gave out, leading to the wings collapsing. But that's another story. Anyway, Blériot is flying two or three times. He seems to be headed back into the channel. Finally, by some miracle, the fog seems to lift. And when he looks down, he sees, you have to understand also that in this day there are absolutely no flying instruments. These guys are flying literally blind, blinded by the clouds up there in the open cockpit, blinded by the fact that they have no instruments. But he's flying, he looks down, the skies are cleared, and he sees three or four huge ships steaming toward obviously a port. He said, that has got to be the port of Dover. And so he just gets down and he follows them, and sure in hell, he sees the white cliffs of Dover. And then he looks for land. He doesn't land. He crashes. He smashes into the land above the cliffs of Dover, looks out and says, I don't care. I made it. And he did. And he becomes the first great aviation hero, because he not only has made it, he's not only claimed this enormous prize, but he has inspired all over the world, people all over the world, that it can be done.
Right. We should mention while Wilbur Wright was doing this, Orville was demonstrating the Wright flyer for U.S. Army officials. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I forgot to say it. Yeah. Well, you always save me with it. Well, while this is going on in France with Wilbur giving his demonstrations, Orville is demonstrating the plane to the Army, hoping to get a big contract. And on one of the last flights before he gets his contract, he goes up in the air with Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge, who is the Army's chief expert on flight. And he's his chief supporter of the Army buying Wright planes. And the engine fails, and they crash, and Orville barely survives. He will be sort of crippled for the rest of his life in his leg. Thomas Selfridge becomes the first man in the history of the world to die in a plane crash. So, you know, everything is a first at this time, because it's a crazy, crazy world. You can't copyright a title, but you don't ever want to use a title that someone else has used that's popular. I mean, I would have killed to have been able to call this book The Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. But that's what they were. Exactly what they were. And you know, I mean, I'm going to jump ahead just for a second, as I always do. But
Wait, before you jump ahead, I want to ask you about Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge. He gets killed. You know, Orville's injured. Did this tragedy have any impact on the enthusiasm for flying?
No, it didn't. And in fact, what I write in the book, and I use quotes, is I think Some of them are flying for the glory of it. Some of them are flying for the adventure of it. These guys, the more dangerous it is, you know, the more dangerous it is, the more they attract certain people. I mean, I sort of equate it to Formula One on car racing. I said, there are people, not me. I'm a practicing coward, Mindy. But there are people in this world who are so drawn to danger. And the danger of this drew these people. And, man, there couldn't have been anything more dangerous than doing this.
Yeah. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Race Through the Skies, The Week the World Learned to Fly. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Race Through the Skies, The Week the World Learned to Fly. So while this is happening, there's an international air meet that was being planned for Brands France. Who was behind the planning and organizing of this meet, and what was the purpose?
Okay, so this becomes the first international air meet. It's going to be a week-long event that will change the history of the world. It changes, certainly changes it. The best quote I found about it was, it said that before REMS, the airplane was a toy. After REMS, it was about to change the world. And it did. The people in REMS was a very famous area of France, known for its cathedral, known for the cathedral where Joan of Arc crowned the king. The whole thing. It had 6 miles from it was the Plains of Bethany, where there had been some of the most historic European ancient battles. And most important for our story, the area around REMS was the greatest grape-growing, champagne-producing area in the world. And there were several of these guys who owned the largest champagne-producing companies that saw a great opportunity. They are going to get together. They're going to pool their money, and they are going to sponsor the first international air meet. And they're going to offer huge prizes, and they're going to have special events all week long. And they think they can get a pretty good crowd. And if they get a pretty good crowd and build enough concession stands, they'll sell a lot of champagne. The point is that before they're done, they draw 1 million fans. They sell tens of thousands of cases of champagne. But most important of all, they introduce the world to aviation. So that when they introduce, and this is only a month after Blériot has flown the channel, they draw, with the exception of Wilbur Wright. Wright does not enter REMS because he's going back to get more contracts, and he's going back to get more patents. But all the other great flyers in this infant world of aviation enter. So you've got Hubert Latham, you've got looking for revenge for having not been the one to win the prize over the channel. You've got Blériot. You've got a guy named Henry Farman who has flown further than anyone else in the world at this point, and you've got other guys that no one's ever heard of yet, like Louis Paulham, who they certainly will have heard of, and a guy named Eugene Lefebvre, who will become the first stunt pilot in the history of the world. And they have 7 days. What they do is they transform the Plains of Bethany into a combination World's Fair, World Series, Carnival, airplane racing course. It's an extraordinary sight, so that when these thousands and thousands of people head for the planes, by the time they get there, there's not a hotel room in the area. They're sleeping on the ground. The roads are covered with tents with people staying, but it's a whole extraordinary festive area. Sociologists love to study this week because it's the first time in European history where the rich and the poor and all those in between get together to see this incredible. I mean, there were huge crowds just gathered around just when the planes were dragged out of the hangars. Many of the spectators jumped out of the stands to help drag the planes because No one had ever seen it. Very few people in the world had ever seen this thing called an airplane before.
Well, you know, you talked about, you know, extreme sports or the thrill seekers. But if you look back at the list of entrants in the air meet, many of them had little or no flying experience.
My favorite story, Mindy, is a guy named Bono Varilla. Bono Varilla was 17 and a half years old. The week before REMS, his rich father gave him a present, an airplane. He didn't get into the damn thing until he flew for the first time at REMS. I mean, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
No, because you've had me on the show, thank gosh, so many times, in which I keep saying, you know, I love the slogan, I go by the slogan, you couldn't make it up. You sure in hell couldn't make this up. You've got, you know, sort of experience. There's nobody a really experienced pilot, but you've got guys like Blatham and Blurio and Latham, but the one guy from the United States, only one from the United States. He happens to be the most famous United States pilot, and his name is Glenn Curtiss. He will eventually become the number one airplane maker in the world. He's already the motorcycle champion of the speed champion of the world. But then you got all these other guys who've never even flown before. But the prizes are enormous, and the glory of doing this. I mean, every front page for the entire week of that meet, the headlines had to do with REMS. I mean, it was like when we first had John Glenn going up. It truly, right. It was absolutely the same thing. And it's an extraordinary event. You've got an enormous restaurant there.
600. Seat 600 people,
day.
Yeah.
You can seat over 1,000 people. You've got post offices where 50,000 postcards a day are being sent to people saying, I'm at REMS, and you won't believe what's going on. You've got barbershops. You've got beauty parlors. You've got it's a city.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I want to know more about Eugene Lefebvre. You mentioned him. Uh-huh. He was an engineer, taught himself to fly. Was a chief pilot for the French Wright Company, but he was known as a stunt flyer who provided comic relief. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Tragically, he dies, most unknown of them all. And what he does is he doesn't win any of the events. He comes in third in a couple, but he becomes the most popular. Except for Blériot, who's the hometown French people's favorite, he becomes the most popular pilot of them all because he goes up in the air every day and he starts diving toward the stands where comes so close that women faint in the grandstand, and then he pulls it out. He starts flying around loops, and it looks like he's going to crash, and the crowd screams, and then he pulls out of it. He buzzes the police and the mounted soldiers who are there to guard people. He just is the most entertaining. On the second day of the meet, when the president of France comes, he buzzes the president of France to salute him. I mean, it's they love Eugene Lefebvre. And when the meet is over, the officials of the meet give a special award to him for his special contributions to this thing. There are several events that go on the 8 days of this event. One of them is one of the most important is, and every day you can compete for these different ones, and in the end, who did it the best. There's the competition for who can fly the furthest. There's a competition who can fly the highest. There are three different speed events: one for once around the track, one around the course, once for two laps around the course, and the most important one of all, the biggest thing, and again, it's by a prize. Who can go the fastest? Three times around the course, and then there's also a special prize for who can take up the most passengers. Now, you know, given how early you can, one of the great indications of how early this is in the flight aviation, the guy who wins it is Farman, because he takes two people up. No one has ever taken two people up in a plane before.
Well, I guess, tragically for Lefevre, he dies 10 days after the air meet in a crash, right?
He dies, and you know, we're going to talk about the flights after REMS. Some of the most important flights in the history of flight, they die afterwards. It's
dangerous.
It's almost a death wish to get into these planes. They're so unstable. And the motors are so underdeveloped for what they're trying to do. And they're pushing the envelope all the time. I know you're going to give me time to talk about Rogers' flight across the United States.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. But I want to jump too far ahead. You include some incredible photographs, some firsthand accounts from the pilots themselves, as well as the media reactions. So tell us a little bit about your research for the book.
Well, you know, I've always told you that's the most fun part of it for me. For me, doing what I do is like a big detective hunt, and it's all, you know, I'm my own research staff because I want to find the stuff, because sometimes when I find the stuff, it turns the whole story around, and no matter how good a researcher is, he or she is not going to do that. They're just going to give me the great information. But the other thing is, many times I find the topic for my next book or my book down the line from what I find in researching. Researching this was terrific. I mean, I discovered there was only one aviation magazine published during these days. This is all taking place in 1908, 1909. There was only one. And I spent an awful lot of time finding back copies of those. But once I found that, I really had a goal of mine. But there are all other kinds of sources. You know, you do this as long as I do, and you start to know where to look, and you start to know what's not really true, and don't use that source. But right. And what I try to do in every one of my books is I try to let the people in the story tell the story as much as I can. And fortunately, you got guys like Latham and Blurry who love to talk and who love the press, and the press love them, so that we were able to get wonderful accounts by the people who did this. I actually spend more time researching than I do writing. And if I do my research right, and if I organize my research right, you know, after 62 books, if I can't write it right, I got to throw the pen away.
So I want to talk about day four of the meet. Fournier was forced to make an emergency landing in a field nearby to the meet. Where the plane went down was far enough away from the spectators that they did not know if he survived. So tell us what happens next. He comes galloping back, right?
This is when he comes back on horseback?
Yeah.
Well, what happened is that when they planned this meet, they, you know, it's on the plains of Bethany, but you know, by this time Bethany is no longer a battlefield. Bethany is the plains themselves are surrounded by cornfields and crops and farmers thing, and they got the farmers to promise they would not roll their hay and keep it out there, and they would not put up corn stalks during this first week, or they removed them so that in case anybody got in trouble outside the flight course itself, there'd be good landing. Well, the farmers did not do that. That was their lifeblood. So there were a couple of crashes that took place in these fields. To me, the great miracle of REMS is that nobody died. Lots of crashes. Blériot kept crashing. Lots of crashes, but no one died. But this one guy is up there, and he's flying, and what was great is there are lots of grandstands, and they're trained on, they're facing, of course, the courts, but people can turn around and look out on these fields, and they see this plane go down and go down into the pile of corn stalks and hay rolls, and they know this guy is dead. And then all of a sudden, what had happened is there were mounted soldiers trying to keep order, through the whole thing. They galloped out and saved this guy, and they brought him back and circled around the racetrack to the great cheers of the crowd. It was one of the great moments of the race. The guy never won anything, but he became a great hero.
All right, so day seven is the race for the Gordon Bennett Cup, the speed
race. All right,
now
that's the biggest.
Yeah.
When I was telling you about all the events, I was going to name it, but I had forgotten the name.
Yeah.
Gordon
yeah, so the
Bennett,
Gordon Bennett
the
Cup, yeah.
This is the New York this Herald is, Tribune. So he's very much like, he's, you know, he's a successor to Lord Northcliffe with his Daily Mail. He's given even a bigger cash award for something that gets that he names for himself, the Gordon Bennett Cup. The Gordon Bennett Cup, by the way, goes on for years. This is one of the first ones, but it goes on for years and years. But in this race, this is the by far the biggest event, and it's saved for the next to last day. The big event on the last day is the altitude race, but that's something else again. But on the this is the most important, most famous air race in the world. And there are two main contenders. Now, everybody's going to enter it because it's such a big prize and so prestigious. But everyone knows that one of two guys is going to win this. It's either going to be Blériot or it's going to be Curtis. Blériot's flying all the time. He's crashing all the time. He's flying again. Curtis is being very careful because Blériot and Latham and Farnham and all these guys, Farman and all these guys, other guys, they had brought entourages with them. And so they had not only cooks and a slew of mechanics, but they had extra planes and they had a slew of extra parts. Curtis came over with one plane and not many extra parts, even though he was the best mechanic of them all, so that he couldn't take as many practice flights for fear of crashing as the others did. And he had to be very careful. But he is, by the time we get to the Cup, it's obvious that, because he's won one of the speed prizes already, it's obvious that it's going to be between Blériot and Curtis. And Blériot goes first. It's three laps, and he flies brilliantly, and he takes incredible chances. And when he lands, Curtis, who's looking on, says, "I have no chance." And the French crowd goes nuts. And now it's Curtis's turn. And Curtis decides for the first time in his life, he's going to risk his life. He's just going to go for it. He knows that there are certain places where there are air pockets. If you fly through it, you could crash in a minute. But also it will propel you faster. He says, for the first time in my life, I'm going to fly deliberately through them. And he does. And when he lands, he's absolutely convinced that he gave it the best go he could have, that he probably lost by about a minute, given how fast Blériot won. And as he's rolling along the ground, suddenly every American in that grandstand, and there were a lot of them, comes roaring up, running up to it, pulls him out. He won by 6 seconds. And
wow.
So now we've had Blériot at one point, you've had Wright at one point, you've had Blériot at one point. Now the greatest aviation hero in the world is Glenn Curtis. And, you know, it's interesting. He dies early, too, but he doesn't die from a plane crash. He just dies from an illness. He becomes a great... We've all heard stories about the guys who somehow knew enough to start buying property in the swamplands of Florida and in the heat of Florida. And Curtis was one of those. He bought up whole towns and became very wealthy and then went in for something like an appendix operation and died. But during his lifetime, he invents the seaplane. One of the seaplanes that he invents, by the way, becomes the first plane to fly across the Atlantic, but not nonstop. It has to put down a couple of places for repairs, and the first place it has to put down is in this place outside of a place called Chatham, Massachusetts, where they have to take it into the Chatham Naval Air Station in 1913 for repairs. But he eventually flies all the way to London. But that's another story. The point is that... I digress. The point is that the Glenn Curtis is the most prestigious one. He wins that. Latham gets his revenge because Latham wins the altitude flying higher than anybody could ever imagine anyone could have flown. Henry Farman wins the it's another good story. He wins the distance thing, and when he comes back, he's gone so far and he's coming back so late that no one's there. So he just keeps circling to add mileage on with no one even there to see it, and then lands.
That's right. As you say, could make it up. We're talking with Martin Sandler. His new book is Race Through the Skies, The Week the World Learned to Fly. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Martin Sandler about his new book, Race Through the Skies, The Week the World Learned to Fly. All right, so Belarus had a catastrophic crash, right, on day 8. Tell us what happened there.
Well, what do you mean with Blériot crashes?
Yes, Blériot, yeah.
Once again, I'm sorry if I had the book in front of me, which I don't. It wouldn't matter, but I'd pronounce it wrong. But there was a phrase that they used for Blériot. As much of a hero he was, they always added the man who always crashes. Blériot gets too close to the grandstand, and his wingtip hits one of the stanchions, and he goes down and in a ball of fire. And they are absolutely, absolutely convinced that he's going to die. This is one of the last of the speed races. And somehow they pull him out, and they put the fire out, and he survives. And as I said before, Mindy, you know, it's amazing. You have so many of these crashes. You can't have an 8-day air meet not have a lot of crashes. I mean, just getting off the ground in those days, with these flimsy planes, there are no runways. There are no beacons. There's nothing. They're just they're going along this incredibly rough ground, and you're just holding your breath that they're going to get up in the air. There's so many crashes even before they get airborne, and then once they're airborne, will the motor last and or conk out, or will the wings collapse, which happens so often? One of the other things I neglected to say is that during Blériot's flight, he's the reason Blériot makes it and Latham doesn't make it is because Blériot's got the engine he invented. And it's an engine that spits oil all over him. I mean, he gets burns every time he flies. It spits all over the open cockpit. It's lucky it doesn't set the plane on fire. But it doesn't conk out. It continues to go. We're so far away from any kind of safety in flight. But again, if there was safety in flight, half of these guys wouldn't have gone, I'm pretty sure. It reminds me very, very much of a book you and I have talked about before, my book on the Resolute. And you ask yourself, why would these guys go to try to find the Northwest Passage, knowing they're going to be stuck in the ice for at least a year? Some of them are going to be stuck in the ice for 2 or 3 years during the winter. Why would they do it? And of course it's the glory, and of course it's money, but it's also some of these guys are just looking for the adventure of it.
Yeah, thrill seekers. Yeah, I know you want to talk about Cal Rogers, so tell us about Cal Rogers. We're going to run out of time if you don't talk about Cal Rogers.
Oh, come on, I got 4 hours. Let's go. All right, I was going to talk about Cal Rogers, and I always step on your toes, and I'm sorry, but you do bring me back. But what happens is that REMS is really the most important. The week at REMS is the most important week in the history of aviation because, as I said, before it, nobody was taking aviation, even with the flight over the channel. Okay, so that's a one-on. You know, that's a fluke. But after REMS, after they see guys like Latham fly that high, after they see guys like Farnham fly that far, after these guys say, hey, we're just beginning. What do you see what we can do once we get better engines? What do you see what we do when we can stabilize these planes? People absolutely know that that's the future. And so what it does, it inspires all kinds of things. There's a guy named George Chavez who decides that he's going to be the first to fly over the Alps. And he flies over the Alps, and he makes it. And on his when he lands in Italy, he crashes and dies. But he makes it. It's interesting. I'm a big tennis fan. And for years, I have watched Roland Garros, the French Open, because I love Rafael Nadal. I never knew what Roland Garros was. Roland Garros was one of the guys sitting at REMS, a young man sitting at REMS, watching what was happening, getting so inspired he stopped everything else he was doing, took aviation license, and bought a plane. He becomes the first man to fly across the Mediterranean. Then World War I starts. he becomes a World War One pilot. There's a great, when World War One starts, people are saying the airplane won't be much good in this war. Well, what they do in the beginning and for the first year and a half of the, they have a big role. They're observation planes, and they're, for the first time, you can observe troop movements from the sky. That's a big advance. They'd love to use them as fighter planes. The problem is they keep shooting their own propellers off and dying because no one has figured a way to shoot a machine gun through the straight ahead and not shoot off the propeller. Garros does it. He finds a way to synchronize I'm no technical person. I can't tell you how. But he finds a way to synchronize the firing of the machine gun with a rotation of the propeller blades, and he changes the whole nation of aerial warfare. And then he gets captured, and then he escapes, and then he dies in a crash. But the stadium where the French Open is played is called Roland Garros, and it should be, because he's a great hero. So that's one of the other flights. What really happens immediately after Rems is that there are three great international, well, all of a sudden every nation starts to have an international air meet. And there's three that take place in 1910 in the United States. There's a big one. The biggest one is in Los Angeles, where a new guy named Graham White emerges as another great hero of the air. There's one over this body of water in Squanum, Massachusetts, which is Quincy, and it's the Boston-Harvard air meet. It's best remembered now by those of us who follow aviation, those of us who study aviation, because at that time, the greatest female, there were no female pilots at, REMS, but females were starting to make a name for themselves. Later, they become the best of all the daredevil flyers. And there's a woman named Harriet Quimby, who's probably the best of all the females. It's an amazing story, and it's, I could talk for 4 hours on that one. I mean, she was a fashion editor, a fashion writer.
Your next book. That's your next book, yeah.
That's my next book.
That's your next
Harriet
book.
Harriet Quimby. We'll write it right now. Harriet Quimby is at the Harvard-Boston air meet, and the guy who is running the meet begs her to take him up for a flight. So in full view of the thousands of people there, she takes him up for a flight. The wings fall off, and Harriet Quimby, the greatest of all the female pilots, dies in Quincy Bay, Squanum Bay. There are a couple of things that take place afterwards, though, immediately after, in 1910 and 1911. Again, inspired by REMS. One, there is the first, there is another big prize by another newspaper publisher is put up for a race between London and Manchester. The first man the fastest time that can be made flying between London and Manchester. And it's a great race, and Lewis Paulham wins it, and it would take me the rest of the program to talk about that. But it then sets up what, for that era, is the greatest air race of them all. It's the first real great air race. And that is, the Amor Company has just come out with a new grape drink. It's called Jim Fizz. And they want to sponsor a race across the United States, the first transcontinental race. It's got to be done in a certain number of hours. You could stop, but you've got to complete it in a certain number of hours. And the first person who can do that wins an enormous prize. Well, you know, there aren't many, even though we've come so far now, there aren't many who are going to be willing to get in this one of these planes and fly it completely across the United States to the West Coast, from East Coast to West Coast. But there's a guy named Cal Rogers who decides he's going to do it. He's, you know, again, he's one of these magnificent men in the flying machines. He's always got a cigar in his mouth. He's always got goggles on. He's always got his baseball hat turned backwards. And he takes off from upper state New York on the Hudson, and he's going to fly to California, and he's going to do it in a time. Mindy, he crashes 56 times. 56 times he crashes. 20 times he winds up in the hospital. 6 or 7 times he winds up in casts. By the time he gets to California, The only piece on that plane, of the original plane, is one wing strut. They've had to put it together so many times. They had to put him together so many times. By 19 hours, he doesn't get any money because he's 19 hours late, having been in the hospital and having been in the mechanic shop. But being Cal Rogers, he says, wait a minute, I landed in California, but I didn't get to the Pacific. So he gets back in the plane. I think they have to put him in the plane. He's got so many casts on. And he puts his wheels down in the Pacific. And then he recovers for the next 2 weeks, and now he's going to make a memorial celebratory Circle of the Pacific, and he does, and he crashes, and he dies.
Marty, why do you think Americans know so little about REMS today?
I don't know. Why do they know so little about history today? I just don't know. I know I went to. That's what made me start doing all this stuff for the last 60 years. When I went to school, they gave me a book and said, here's the list of the 35 presidents. Go home and memorize them and give them back to me in order tomorrow. That was a hell of an important assignment, you know? I mean, we didn't write it right. We didn't teach it right. We didn't realize that nonfiction is a hell of a lot more exciting than fiction if it's done right, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I, you know, my wife keeps saying to me, will you please stop saying you couldn't make it up? People are bored with that. Well, but it's what it's all about. I mean, it's just... It's extraordinary. It's just truly extraordinary.
All right, so we got about a minute left. Did the festival receive a lot of press in the U.S. at that time?
Yeah, it did. The REMS became very, very famous. I'm amazed, and of course was delighted, that I only found one book ever written about it. And I found a hell of a lot of stuff that never got into that book. And it just... I don't quite understand it, but I never do. I mean, you know, how come when I wrote my book on the letters of John F. Kennedy, how in the world could that have been the first book ever done on the most popular, on the letters of the most popular president of the 20th century? I mean, I shouldn't knock it, you know, but you could write three more books on that. You know, there's so much I had to leave on the cutting room floor because so much took place. And these people are such extraordinary characters, you know.
Right. I mean, you could write a book individually about any one of these guys.
Could write a book on Blériot, on Latham, on Lefebvre, on Sir. You know what happens is you go to read a book about Curtis. It's not really about his life. It's about, you know, these flight and that flight and this flight. But these guys led incredible lives.
Yeah, amazing.
Just amazing.
Martin Sandler is the author of more than 60 books. He's received a National Book Award and many other accolades. His latest book is Race Through the Skies, The Week We Learned to Fly. We'll post more information about Marty and his books at our website, capeandislands.org. Marty Sandler, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. You know it's always a joy. Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.